Welcome to the Ogletree Deacons Podcast, a quick digest of compelling legal issues and practical insights delivered to you in less than 20 minutes.
Welcome to the May edition of our Third Thursday podcast. I'm Ruthie Goodbow, a labor attorney and shareholder with Ogletree Deacons. I also serve as the firm's co-chair of our traditional labor practice. Joining me today is Sarah Keenel, a shareholder out of our St. Louis and Tampa offices. Good to have you with us, Sarah.
Glad to be here, Ruthie.
Quick fun fact about Sarah. She's affiliated, as I said, with two offices because she's a military spouse. And right now, her husband is based out of the Florida Panhandle.
That's right. After I took my third bar exam in Florida, I told my husband, I'm staying here. Ruthie, too, is a military spouse, though Ruthie, I believe you were lucky enough to avoid multiple bar exams.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's lucky or just old so that I was able to wave in. And talking about how long I've been practicing, so about 20 years, and I'm still surprised to find that employers often have the misperception that the National Labor Relations Act applies only to unionized employers. As we all know, Section 7's provision allowing employees to gauge in concerted activity extends to both union and non-union environments alike. Now, some months back, we did a podcast on handbooks and policies talking about the good news about the more employer-friendly standard for the lawfulness of employee work rules. And that was announced in the 2017 Boeing case. Sarah, can you quickly remind us, why is that case so important?
Sure. Specifically there, the board said that in evaluating a policy, it will strike to seek a balance between two things. First, the nature and extent of the potential impact of the policy on employee Section 7 rights. And second, the employer's legitimate justifications associated with the rule. So it's going to weigh the employee rights versus the employer's justification. Following up on the NLRB's decision, the NLRB General Counsel, Peter Robb, issued a new guidance memorandum detailing how NLRB regional offices receiving claims of improper employment policies are to interpret employer workplace rules. For non-union employers, Section 7 comes up often in employer policies and handbook provisions, which is what we're going to talk about today.
So? How does that come up?
Under the Obama board precedent, if a policy in any way could have been interpreted to chill an employee's Section 7 rights, the board found the policy unlawful. We saw policies fall under scrutiny, even if they just arguably policed conduct that was protected by 7, even where the employer did not actually use the policy in a way that violated employee rights. And that came up for union and non-union employers alike.
Always helpful to me. Give me an example.
A general civility policy is a good example. We often see employers legitimately want employees, to act cooperatively toward their peers and their management. Those types of policies, though, either in theory or in practice, could be used to discipline employees who complained about work conditions. So if a policy saying be nice to your supervisor could be used to discipline an employee for Section 7 rights, those policies were invalid under the Obama board precedent. Other examples are policies requiring employees to refrain from conduct that impedes harmonious interactions or relationships, or prohibit abusive or threatening language to anyone on company premises. And that seems pretty logical that we would not want our employees to use abusive or threatening language to anyone on company premises. But again, in theory, that could be used to discipline employees for engaging in concerted protected activity. One area that seemed to be a flashpoint under the Obama board were policies related to what employees could say on social media. The general counsel's memo gives us examples of specific policies that are to be found lawful and also directs regional offices not to interpret ambiguous rules against the drafter. It further clarifies that generalized provisions should not be interpreted as banning all activity that conceivably could be included within the rule. In other words, it directs us to look at how the rule is actually used in practice rather than its abstract implications. The NLRB will now look to whether a rule would be interpreted as prohibiting Section 7 activity, as opposed to whether it could conceivably do so. Going forward, work rules are to be categorized in three categories under this new guidance. First, rules that are generally lawful to maintain. Second, rules warranting individualized scrutiny. And third, rules that are plainly unlawful to maintain.
For the purposes of our discussion today, and I hope I remember this correctly, Category 1 rules include things, as you just mentioned, civility rules, rules against disruptive behavior, what I would call kind of standard employer policies. Category 2 rules, these are the ones that are assessed on a case-by-case basis, includes things like broad rules against disparagement or criticism of the employer, as opposed to a civility rule. Rules related to conduct that might harm the employer, as opposed to rules banning insubordination or disruptive conduct. Now, Category 3, which are rules that are unlawful on their face, some of those might be things like confidentiality rules that specifically prohibit an employee from talking about wages, benefits, or working conditions. So in the context of these categories, let's talk a little bit about one of those flashpoints you mentioned, social media.
As I mentioned earlier, social media is often a flashpoint, both as it relates to the policies themselves and how employers discipline employees for what they do on social media. Ruthie, what are the recent developments in this area?
Glad you asked that. There's actually a recent advice memorandum that's just been released by the General Counsel. Now, this memorandum was actually drafted in August of last year, but only released in the last few weeks. The advice memorandum is Colorado Professional Security Services. In the underlying case, the employer maintained, I'll do the air quotes, harm to business reputation policy, and then discharged an employee for some Facebook posts. It's an interesting memo because while the policy was found to be unlawful, the discharge was found not to have violated the act. Sarah, let's talk about the rule first.
Yes, Ruthie, it is a very interesting opinion. As to the rule, the advice memo concluded that the employer's, using Ruthie's air quotes, harm to business reputation policy, prohibiting employees from criticizing the employer, actually violated Section 8A1 of the National Labor Relations Act. Similarly, the standard disciplinary letter language prohibiting employees from discussing their discipline with coworkers or clients also violated Section 8A1 of the Act. Relying on Boeing, a decision Ruthie discussed in an earlier podcast, the memo reasoned that the provisions at issue are Category 2 rules, so those that are analyzed on a case-by-case basis. Here, in this case, they were unlawful because the impact on employee rights outweighed the employer's business justification for having the rules. Regarding the policy, by prohibiting any public criticism of the employer or its management, the employer was expressly interfering with any appeals to the public in labor disputes, a key component of Section 7 rights, and the employer did not have a legitimate business justification for that kind of total full-scale ban. Similarly, by prohibiting employees from discussing their discipline with others, the employer interfered with employees' rights to communicate with others or third parties about a term of their employment, again, without a legitimate justification, which violated the employee's Section 7 rights.
So I understand why advice came out the way they did, although I do think it's interesting that their analysis was based on a finding that those rules and that document were Category 2 and not Category 3, which you'll remember are unlawful on their face. To me, that indicates a change from the previous board and is certainly encouraging because it gives an employer the ability to justify these kinds of rules based on the particulars of their business or maybe a particular industry. Okay, so the rule was found to be unlawful. If that's the case, how is it that the discharge of the employee for violating that rule was not?
That's a great question, Ruthie. While the employees were discharged, at least in part, for violating what was found to be an unlawful rule, the discharge was not unlawful because the Facebook post at issue did not constitute protected concerted activity. the conduct was so egregious that other employees would not connect the discharge to the overbroad aspect of the rules. So even though the post referred to subjects that could have been relevant to an employee's mutual aid and protection, including the wage and hour issues, a confidentiality instruction, there was no indication that the employee was speaking for other employees or was engaging in an attempt to call them to action. The comments were instead, according to the board, more along the lines of individual complaints or mere griping, which is not protected under Section 7. In addition, the employee made crude, disparaging, and dismissive jokes, and the comments were found to rise to the level of gross misconduct. The board reasoned that the offensive and even threatening remarks were made while the employee was on duty and in uniform, which would plainly be seen as the basis for the discharge, not the violation of the unlawful rule.
The good news here is it's not just the GC that's taken this position. The board just issued a couple of decisions on these points as well. The first one is Quicken Loans, Inc. There, the employer fired a mortgage banker who was overheard in a restroom engaging in a discussion which involved profanity about a client. The board rejected the complaint, saying the employee's comments were not concerted activity. While criticizing customers can be protected in some circumstances, here the board characterized the conversation, the term you used, as mere griping. The employee in question did not discuss taking any action in regard to the situation, nor was there any evidence of systematic problems. So this was found to be a personal complaint. So Sarah, why don't you tell us about the other related decision in Allstate Maintenance? Some more good news.
Right. And a quick point, as you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, and we've talked about throughout, these decisions impact both union and non-union employers. And the Allstate Maintenance decision that I'm going to discuss is a good example of how this could come up for non-union employers, as well as a good example of how the board is taking a turn back to an employer-friendly stance. There, the board overruled Obama-era precedent, substantially narrowing what is considered protected concerted activities. The board expressly overturned a 2011 ruling that held that a single employee who gripes in a group setting is automatically engaged in protected activities under the National Labor Relations Act. And it did so rejecting a mandatory rule that an employee who complains in a group setting are engaging in protected concerted activity, reasoning that reaching that conclusion conflates the concept of group setting and group complaints. It reiterated that simply making a complaint in the presence of others does not, standing alone, mean it is concerted. Instead, determining whether an employee has engaged in protected concerted activity requires consideration of all the surrounding facts. The board identified five factors that tend to support an inference that an employee's complaint is intended to induce group action and would therefore be concerted. And those five factors all relate to the context of the statement. So was the statement made in an employee meeting called by the employer to announce a decision affecting a term or condition of employment? Does the decision at issue affect multiple employees attending the meeting? Is the employee who speaks up doing so in response to the announcement in an effort to protest or complain about the decision? Or are they instead asking questions about how the decision has been or will be implemented? In the latter case, if it's just questions, it may not be protected concerted activity. The fourth factor is whether the speaker protests or complains about the decision's effect on the workforce generally or some portion of the workforce, not solely him or herself. And finally, was the meeting the first opportunity to address the decision? Was there any opportunity to discuss it with coworkers beforehand? Now, the board's majority explained that not all of these factors are required to support an inference that an employee is seeking to initiate or induce group action, and the question remains a factual one based on the totality of the circumstances. Still, the test gives some guidance on when a complaint made in the presence of a group is an individual or a group issue. The board additionally found in Allstate Maintenance that the employee's complaint did not meet the second prong of the protected concerted activity analysis, finding that it was not made for the purpose of mutual aid or protection. The board relied on the fact that the employee's complaint was not about his employer's tipping policy or practices, but rather the amount of a single tip received the prior year, which the employer had no control over. Accordingly, the board found that the employee's complaint was neither concerted nor had mutual aid or protection as its purpose.
Thanks so much for joining us, Sarah. And thank you, everyone, for listening. This is Ruthie Goodbow. Follow me on Twitter, Ruthie Labor Law. And as always, be bold and mighty forces will come to your aid.
Thank you for joining us on the Ogletree Deacons podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts on iTunes or through your favorite podcast service. And remember, the information in this podcast is for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as legal advice.